Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, after a huge win in the North Carolina House, the bill allowing a referendum on Charlotte's transit plan receives a similar reception in the Senate. It looks like it might actually happen. Much of the eastern U.S., including North Carolina, suffered through the first heat wave of the summer. Heat indices have eclipsed 110 degrees in some places. New rules for street vendors in NoDa. The city will now require a permit in an effort to curb congestion and to ensure food vendors have health permits. But the vendors push back a little. Charlotte leaders decide to stop buying Teslas for their electric vehicle fleet. Not everyone agrees, and the Charlotte Checkers Calder Cup hopes melt away. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News senior editor Eli Portillo. Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City News. And we welcome to the program for his very first news roundup, David Hodges, who is an investigative reporter at WBTV. We kicked Nick to the curb, and David took his place.
David, excuse the film, Mike. Thank you.
So leaders of the General Assembly had been predicting a difficult path for Charlotte's request for a referendum on a sales tax for transit. They said they had a 50-50 chance of getting it through. The bill sailed through the House, though, 104-5, and moved to the Senate, where earlier this week, Senate Leader Phil Berger made passage there sound iffy.
We're waiting for it to come over. I expect us to take it up when it comes over. I don't know that we're going to have the runway to finish it this week is the only is the challenge. And so we'll have to, we'll see what happens when it gets over.
So, Eli, what happened when it got over there?
It passed with very little dissent and, you know, very quickly, pretty much as rapidly as a bill can. It passed its first, second, and third readings and moved back to the House, where it immediately won final approval and sailed over to Governor Stein's desk, where it's sitting now. So from uncertainty and, we'll see what happens attitude, it just moved like that.
How do we explain that? Because it's been 50-50 at best since it went to the legislature. The idea that it would pass was marginal at best. Were they just making it look difficult so we'd be pleasantly surprised, or did something happen?
Well, I think that a lot of times in Raleigh, they need a deadline. They need a hard stop before anything gets done. You see this with a lot of bills. And with the legislative session wrapping up, minus the budget right now, it was do or die time. So as soon as you get to that, hey, we've got to do it, it's actually crunch time moment, the things that they actually want to move suddenly move very, very quickly.
There was some debate in the Senate about how passage of this bill might impact transportation projects in neighboring counties. Some on the Senate Finance and the Senate Rules Committees questioned why the authority to put a referendum on the ballot was limited to just Mecklenburg County. Well, we asked for it, that's why. But Forsyth Democrat Paul Lowe said he didn't want to crush Mecklenburg's chances, but added he wanted the same opportunities for his community. Why is that a concern? Wouldn't they be able to do the same thing we did if they asked for it?
Sure, they would have to ask for it and receive legislative approval. I think there's probably, I'm inferring here, but probably a little thought of, oh, gee, if they're actually going to make it, can we just get added to that really quickly? Because remember, Charlotte has been pursuing this for almost 5 years now.
Well, let me ask.
So folks, other counties, they're saying, whoa, that's a long road.
Let me ask a question. Does the passage of this set a precedent?
You know, I think you could say that, but at the same time, remember, it's not like the courts where there's legal precedents and they stand. The legislature changes with the legislators. So, yeah, I think a precedent is only extends as far as the session.
Ryan.
And you have to remember that how this sped up after Tricia Cotham really became the sponsor to it. And she's really a darling of the Republican Party now because of the way that she flipped over there and gave them their supermajority at the time. Other counties don't sort of have that darling that has that sort of pull the way that she was able to sort of shove this through, and they would
and Vicky Sawyer on the Vicky Sawyer as well on the Senate side. So it's got the backing of popular legislators, which is a great point. You might not have if you're from Forsyth or something.
So this bill has been changed a little bit. It's morphed a lot over time, but it essentially passed in the form that we sent it to the legislature in, where the breakdown is what, 40-40-20, 40 for roads, 40 for rail, 20 for buses.
Yep.
Of the money. But they did, the Senate did add something to it. They limit how that road money can be used. Explain that.
So Steve Harrison, WFAE's politics reporter, did some digging into comments that Charlotte City Manager Marcus Jones had made. And, Marcus Jones was talking about, hey, we're going to get this new sales tax money that can fund roads and take some of the pressure off our general property tax fund. So basically, he was saying we can shift some funding that we're putting towards roads now to other priorities like city employee pay and that sort of thing, and backfill it with this new sales tax money. So the legislature, the Republicans in the legislature, were not happy to hear that. They said, wait a second, we want to see a net funding increase for roads. We don't want you robbing Peter to pay Paul. We don't want you just moving the money around and keeping the total amount the same. So they added a provision that cities have to maintain their road funding at the average of the last 10 years. So that, and then they can add new funding from the sales tax. So basically, Charlotte will have to keep spending at least the average of its last 10 years on road projects, and then can add that 40% of the new sales tax money on top of it, rather than do a shuffle.
David.
I think the key word he said that really made Republicans in the General Assembly a little nervous was debt service. And when you start talking about taking that money and paying down other projects, they're saying, no, we want this all to go to roads. Roads were a major part of this project in order to get Republicans at the General Assembly on board. And it also took a lot of Republicans in Mecklenburg County pushing this, like you mentioned, Ryan, to get this through. It's a long way from where this started back during the pandemic when former Mayor Harvey Gantt was leading a transit committee and all of this was dead on arrival. So huge evolution.
I could be wrong about this, but isn't the county or the city or both fixing state roads because the state is behind on fixing them, and yet the state is concerned about how we spend our road money?
Yep. The state is responsible for more local roads in North Carolina than any state but Texas because of the way we have arranged the laws here. Basically, any of the major roads you can think of, Providence, Wendover, Brookshire, etc., they're state-owned roads. So city leaders, they point back and say, hey, you guys complain about the roads and spending on the roads. You control all the big roads, so what are you complaining about? So there's definitely some finger-pointing back and forth there.
So Mecklenburg Senator Joyce Waddell of Charlotte told colleagues the passage of this bill is key for our city to be able to handle growth.
But it gives Mecklenburg County the ability to raise local funds for roads and public transportation, which is a vital need.
So now it is in the hands of Governor Josh Stein, who has 10 days to sign it. What is he likely to do?
Get that pen out. Sign it.
And if he signs it, what happens
so
next?
So then it comes back to Mecklenburg County, and the Mecklenburg County Commission will hold a vote on whether they want to put this on the ballot. They're expected to do so. There can always be some last minute surprises, but basically that is expected. And then it will be on the ballot in November for you to vote yes or no on, Mecklenburg County residents.
And they have to mount some sort of a campaign to make people aware of it. First of all, this is an off-year election. And secondly, to, I guess, promote passage of it. Are they allowed to do that? Are they allowed to run advertising that says vote yes?
Outside groups can, you know, business groups like the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance,
right.
Advocacy groups like Sustain Charlotte, which wants to see more transit funding. They have already been rallying supporters and posting about their support, organizing a campaign behind the scenes that I would expect to get active very soon. But the city can't directly come out and do that itself.
Okay, switching gears here. We just went through our first heat wave, or heat dome, as the meteorologists would call it, of the summer. Temperatures in this part of the state reached 100 degrees earlier this week, with heat indices about 110 or more. It was hotter in other parts of North Carolina. This is just the first of what is likely to be more and more prolonged periods of dangerously hot weather. And Mecklenburg County put their heat action plan into effect this week. I'm not sure who to ask about this, but what did that plan do?
It opens some cooling centers around the county. It extends hours at shelters for our homeless neighbors. It opens up rec centers for longer hours where folks can sort of find, find some relief from the heat. It sort of just extends some of the opportunities for folks to get inside, I guess, yeah. Not get out from the heat, but yeah, both.
And I think they put it into effect from Monday through Wednesday, and that pretty much was the span of this. I think yesterday was we broke the back on the heat wave. The city of Charlotte's strategic energy plan identifies extreme heat as the top climate-related threat, but the city does not have a lot of tools to help out, evidently, as City Council's Dimple Ejmero pointed out, in a Dillon Rule state, which we are, where the state government calls the shots on most things, the city cannot force the issue of having or requiring landlords to have air conditioning in their rental properties. But can't the argument be made that if we require those units to be heated, and we do, and we do that to make them habitable, that we should be able to do that to make them habitable in the summertime with air conditioning?
It's a good argument. I think when you look at the way state law is written, you know, it's not required in state law, and the city is always skittish about preempting the state and getting slapped down by Raleigh. There is a rule that if you have air conditioning, it must be in operable order. So if you're a landlord and you have AC, it's got to be working. Your tenants can demand that. But if there's no AC installed, which, yeah, you know, a lot of low-income folks who move in and out, they might bring a window unit and that's that, you don't have to install it. So I think there's around 7,000 living units estimated that don't have it in Charlotte.
It's the local news roundup this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Court, if you're in a rental unit and you're low income, you may not have the money to run that air conditioning to the degree that you would want to in hot days like this. So are there plans for that for people?
There are some, you know, utility subsidy programs that are out there. The county also gives away box fans. Our reporter Stella Mackler went to a box fan giveaway at a senior center, and all 20 box fans that they had for the day were gone immediately that morning. People showed up, senior citizens who needed them because they didn't have AC showed up to claim them, and they were gone very quickly.
Are they on loan or that we give them?
They're a giveaway. You get to keep the box fan.
And we spoke to a physician on this program about the heat wave the other day, and I kind of questioned whether or not fans make a difference, because it's not air conditioning, it's just blowing hot air in your face. But he said yes, because it helps evaporate the perspiration and that cools you down. Hot weather has led to an increasing number of heat-related deaths as climate continues to warm here in Mecklenburg County. And out of all the 100 counties, Mecklenburg has the highest rate of heat-related deaths. With these heat domes, it's hot even at night, and Autumn Locklear, who's an epidemiologist who studies the relationship between climate and health for the state, spoke with WFAE about that.
If the temperature does not drop below 70 degrees overnight, then that can lead to, you know, prolonged heat exposure and more severe health effects.
There was a bill that was winding its way through the General Assembly to require air conditioning. It has stalled out. It was by State Representative Tracy Clark, who calls air conditioning a human right. So it stalled. So we'll see what we know what the others think about that. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Eli Portillo, senior editor of WFAE News, is with us along with David Hodges, investigative reporter for WBTV. Alexandria Sands is here, reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Ryan Pitkin, co-founder and editor of Queen City News. Evidently, the number of street vendors has been on the rise in NoDa, leading to crowded sidewalks and congestion. And this week, Charlotte City Council took action to change that. They debated new permitting requirements for street vendors. Prior to the vote, WFAE spoke with Deja Philippe. She sells lemonade from a folding table about once a week. She supported the permit requirement, as long as it's fair.
As long as when you're getting the permit, it's like easy and affordable to get the permit.
Jesse Titus sells custom t-shirts in the area. He's not opposed either, but he did have some caveats.
I would say there shouldn't be any lines or any paperwork or any fine or anything that stops the vendors from being out here and having a beautiful life.
But Austin Cannon relies on selling leather goods on the street and told us he's worried about how permits would be a setback to those considering entering the business.
If I would have came out here and there would have been vendor fees in the beginning or permits that were required, I would have never gotten the chance to start the business.
So City Council, Ryan, voted unanimously on this. What did they decide?
So they're going to launch a pilot program called the NoDa Street Market that will be basically a permitting process. They're going to choose, I think, four locations where folks can sign up and they can rotate in and out to sell wares, mostly no consumables, mostly merchandise, things like you just mentioned, but not the lemonade. And they will have to pay to do so to apply for this permit if they're approved, but they will keep the cost under $100. That was one of the biggest concerns going into it. They just recently raised the fee in Uptown for the Tryon Street Mall program, which is almost identical to this, except that they just raised that fee to $350 in the new budget. So that was a big concern that they would make it sort of inaccessible to a lot of folks with a high fee like that. But they did emphasize the fact that this fee will be under $100. Four locations around the neighborhood. Other than that, it will be a congested business district. The neighborhood will be designated such, which means that all street vending outside of those permitted spots will be illegal.
So is 100, put this into perspective, if you're selling lemonade on the street or you're selling t-shirts, is $100, is that a heavy lift?
It can be for a one-time fee. I mean, someone in our comments section, which sometimes I do drift into accidentally, mentioned that that's just, you know, even if it were to be $350, that's just a dollar a day. But it's not seen that way. Some of these folks are on their third job and they're just trying to make ends meet. Right. So paying it all at once can be a little bit much.
As I understand it, some local business owners made the point that aside from occasionally blocking sidewalks, these vendors take business away from the more taxed vendors who have stores, and they also sell food without health inspections. That actually surprised me. Why is selling food without health inspections not already illegal?
That actually is. It's just not very, it's not enforced, I would say.
So after the vote, Charlotte Mayor Pro Tem Dante Anderson made the point of saying that these new regulations are not meant to drive vendors out of the area, but they are about public safety.
This was never about an attack on the street vendors, not at all. It was about ensuring that we have a safe environment in a historical part of our city that has infrastructure that is, I would say, quaint and dated.
So when do these go into effect, these rules?
City staff has said that it should launch by the end of July.
Okay. For several weeks this summer, and really for years, airport workers at Charlotte Douglas have been asking for pay raises and improved working conditions. We've heard their voices on the roundup talking about how many of their members sleep in their cars and that the work they do makes it possible for people to fly comfortably. And this week, City Council took a vote on whether or not to study, just to study ways to improve working conditions. And Mayor Vi Lyles broke a tie vote. What did her vote decide, Ryan?
So basically, airport workers and SEIU labor union has been working to get a case ordinance passed that would ensure that these airport workers who are not employed by the city, not even technically employed by American Airlines, but another contractor's Prospect and ABM, and to ensure that they have living wages and better work conditions. Now, this conversation on Monday, it's the second time this conversation has come up. Basically, the city attorney has shot down the idea of the case ordinance because they are not city employees. However, what was discussed on Monday was just literally being able to discuss it further, sending it to committee in order to maybe go over the procurement process of whether they can, you know, they don't have to go for the lowest bidder when they look at who American Airlines brings on to hire these workers. So they wanted to maybe discuss how they could further regulate and make sure that the folks that are going to be hired through these third parties can be treated better, paid better.
So WFAE Steve Harrison reported on this earlier this week. A majority of council members have resisted efforts by that union, the Service Employees International Union, noting that the city cannot dictate to private contractors how much to pay their employees. And prior to the vote, City Council's Marjorie Molina said the city should be careful because the state legislature could get involved if Charlotte is believed to be getting involved with private contracts. Hers was one of the no votes on this, but she wanted to be clear that it wasn't because she didn't support treating those workers fairly.
I don't want it to be misstated that this is something that says that we are not being fair to the people who work subcontract at our airport. And that is not what this message is saying.
So a lot of these workers make $14 an hour. The city recently raised the pay of full-time workers from $23 to $24 an hour. So this vote may not be intended to send a message, but it will be the message received by a lot of those workers. And whether or not that's the case, do they have any other avenues for successfully increasing either the pay or improving their working conditions? Or was this their shot?
Well, I don't think they're done with this avenue. I would expect it to keep coming up in council. And also, you know, we have municipal elections right in November, so we could have a different council in just a few months here. One thing that I thought was interesting is there was an article in the Charlotte Ledger today by Johnny Harris, the business leader and developer, one of the big dogs in Charlotte, specifically about this vote. And he was basically castigating city council for what he called performative activism. And he was, you know, saying that this is an example of the kind of departures from Charlotte's pro-business attitude that it's historically had that he's really concerned about. So even though this vote didn't go anywhere and city council voted not to study this issue, it's clearly raising some hackles in the business community. And to have someone like Johnny Harris come out and, you know, write against it is notable in terms of the interest.
Back up. What's he against?
He's against the idea of Charlotte City Council dictating to a private contractor, trying to say what they pay or
anything. They didn't.
So
they didn't. The mayor voted it down.
He's concerned that it was even a tie vote that the mayor had to break. So
let me ask you
what a departure it is from Charlotte's historical pattern.
Perhaps we don't have the wherewithal or the legal right to tell a private company what they can pay their employees or what should they pay their employees or even how they should treat those employees, but they can choose to do business with companies that reflect their values, can't they?
Sure. And I think that this is an example of, at a deeper level, what are the values of Charlotte? Johnny Harris is saying in his editorial, the values of Charlotte are pro-business, pro-growth, pro-public-private partnership. We're going to be really friendly to businesses
at the expense
and encourage
of workers?
Charlotte's growth. And
at the expense of workers?
I'm not going to put words in his mouth, but the other minority faction on city council is saying, no, it's time to change those values. Charlotte's big enough now that we don't have to just be pro-growth. We can start pushing for more conditions for workers.
And I asked that question about whether we can choose our vendors based on our values, because when Charlotte City Council was discussing the budget a couple of weeks ago, Luana Mayfield on council suggested overlooking one particular brand when buying 45 electric vehicles for the city.
We have a number of EV companies out there now. I would prefer if the city of Charlotte moves in a different direction versus purchasing any more Tesla vehicles.
And she made that statement because she thought the city could make, quote, better choices of tax dollars and identify companies that align with the city's goals and expectations. And this week, council decided to remove Tesla from their list of manufacturers from whom they buy future vehicles. Mayfield was part of the push to get that passed, but she insisted this week that her opposition was not due to Elon Musk's relationship with Donald Trump, but over safety issues.
So it is not about just the particular owner of this product. It is the fact that this product has been in multiple lawsuits because of safety issues, and there are multiple concerns.
So did she specify what those multiple concerns were, Eli?
No, I don't think so. But I think, media coverage of things like Tesla's being involved in accidents when in self-driving mode and the struggles that Elon Musk has had in terms of producing products that have a lot of recalls. You know, there have been many product recalls on the Cybertruck for panels falling off, on other models for software problems. So she was pointing to those. I mean, I can't infer what's in her mind. But it's also kind of a, well, come on moment. This isn't related to Elon. Are you for real?
I think Councilmember Ed Driggs tried to infer what was in her mind and say that this was purely political in nature. And to your point earlier, Eli, about Johnny Harris writing about the Charlotte Airport, a lot of what's kind of going on in politics right now seems to be somewhat political and performative.
Yeah. And you mentioned Ed Driggs, David. He was quick to note that Tesla isn't the only automobile manufacturer with recall and legal issues.
I think we just set a dangerous precedent if we have reasons that aren't related to the cost and the performance of purchased items for excluding them. We already have Teslas in the fleet.
So the decision came on a 6-3 vote. Driggs, newly appointed Republican Edwin Peacock, and Democrat Dimple Ejmera voted no. Voting yes were Dante Anderson, Malcolm Graham, Renee Johnson, Victoria Watlington, and Tijuana Brown, along with Luana Mayfield. Did any of the other council members who voted to remove Tesla as a purchase option give their reasons, or did they just vote?
I didn't catch their reasons if they gave them. I think they just voted.
Okay. Queen City Nerve, Ryan, reported this week on a situation resulting from the displacement of otherwise unhoused people living at the Baymont by Wyndham Hotel off Sugar Creek Road. We talked about this, my gosh, what, months or a year ago. This program transitioned from one entity to another in April and May, but has since been shut down. But some families were expelled by the new entity from this hotel. That spilled over into social media and this week into a city council meeting. Give us the details. This is kind of difficult.
Right. I've been reporting on this since April, and long story short, there was a city-funded project from Heal Charlotte that ran there. It was funded for a year. It's called Heal a Home, and it helped folks, women with children, single women with children specifically, find transitional housing while they looked for permanent housing solutions. That program was just, the funding ended, it ran out, it wasn't sustainable apparently, and it ended in April. So Cedric Dean of another program called Help took over. His program was helped other class of folks. It's more of a recovery situation from addiction. So he did not, no longer felt that the families who were left over from the Heal Charlotte program could safely live there. He offered some of them money to leave. Others, he moved into other homes that his organization owns around the city. And then in earlier this month, a woman who was originally part of the Heal Charlotte program and her baby were found dead in their room. That really put another spotlight on this whole situation. About a week later, Cedric Dean shut down his operations at the hotel, saying it was no longer safe. He blamed CMPD for not enforcing any laws over there, saying that it was the whole property and the area around it. There was too much crime and danger. Other people were claiming that he was making things unsafe. Then he started moving folks who were left over at those homes from the Heal Charlotte program out, evicting them, some saying that was illegal evictions. Some folks were staying in those houses, refusing to leave. We've right now got dozens, at least 35 specific families who are still looking for permanent homes. City staff is getting involved in trying to help them with resources after this Monday night city council meeting. It's really just sort of been a mess. Lack of accountability. The city didn't have any involvement with that second program that took over. So it's really just been a sort of a free for all as far as what is going on with these families.
Yeah. And Ryan, I think that's really important to point out that there is no city involvement with this newer program. It's really confusing as you have like a lot of different housing and homelessness programs that have been in place. This one run by Cedric Dean is not funded in any way by the city. And despite his claims in a recent press conference, my research also shows it is not a nonprofit. There's a different funding mechanism that he's more interested in, and that is probably why some of these evictions are happening.
It is the Charlotte Local News Roundup on WFAE's Charlotte Talks.
Alan, and I just wanted to say really quickly, I think this story points to some issues with the surge of funding that happened in the last few years. As Ryan said, it wasn't sustainable, so, you know, a lot of groups that got funding to do ostensibly good things, if there's not a sustainability mechanism beyond that, how do you keep the people housed after the grant runs out? In a lot of cases, we're seeing first-year funding dry up and people kind of left high and dry.
Now, I know we're here in the end of June, and it's really just the beginning of summer kids for a lot of this, Alex, but you reported this week that it's almost back to school time. And CMS has announced that 97% of its teacher positions are filled ahead of the start of the upcoming school year. We talk about this every year. This seems like a much, much higher number than in previous years. Is it?
CMS, their leaders sounded really optimistic when they were delivering this message. They're really proud of having 97% of positions filled. At this point, it's still over 400 teacher vacancies that they need to address before the start of the year. And it just seems like every single year we're talking about this, like hundreds of vacancies. Now, the good thing is that they did start last year with just 276, which still sounds high, but that was a substantial improvement compared to the year prior when they had over 500.
Is this a problem with public schools around the state, with public schools around the country, or is this particular to us?
I mean, North Carolina, we dropped in the ranking, the National Education Association's ranking for the average teacher salary to number 43. So I don't think you can deny that this is a statewide problem. And CMS is, I think the reason they were kind of speaking optimistically about this is because they're really proud of the work that they've had to do to make up for the low statewide pay, like things, some of the work that they're doing to try to help staff with housing and recruitment.
And that we have to stop right there. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks. Eli Portillo is with us, WFAE News Senior Editor. Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. Ryan Pitkin, co-founder and editor at Queen City News. And David Hodges, investigative reporter for WBTV. Since we have these great minds assembled here this morning, let's talk about AI. AI is here.
Artificial. We are all real. We are not ChatGPT.
Yes, but you're all going to be replaced by artificial intelligence. It's here. It's beginning.
Too real, Mike.
It's here. It's beginning to infiltrate every nook and cranny quickly. CMS is grappling with how to deal with AI and even how to bring it into the classroom. Alex, is the reality that students already use AI so it can't be ignored? Is that the reality?
It is the reality, and teachers too. So CMS knows that. They know that it's going to be a part of the future and that the employers that their students go to are going to be urging them to use AI. So that's why they're kind of trying to figure out what they can do to try to intertwine this into the school day while not making it something where students are just brainless and they're using ChatGPT to create content and they're not using critical thinking skills. They're trying to figure out ways that they could use AI to enhance learning or to help them, be more creative.
And you report that when these students graduate and they go out into the workforce will be using AI, so these students might as well be prepared to learn how to use it the most effectively. A CMS collected feedback on all this from more than 10,000 respondents to develop their vision of artificial intelligence. Candace Hellman-Hosey is CMS's chief technology officer, and here's how she described the response.
It was a mixture of scared and curious, just like we all are, because this is uncharted territory, and especially for public school systems. But one of the common themes of the feedback was a safe approach was necessary.
So who were these 10,000 people who participated in this survey, Alex?
I think they had some engagement sessions, but it was an online survey, and it was open to everybody, so even community members could have participated.
So even as they're working on integrating AI into the curricula somehow and into students' lives, you report that CMS blocks AI tools like ChatGPT on the school's networks and also on teachers' take-home devices. How can you embrace AI on the one hand and then lock teachers out of access on the other?
Yeah, I think that just kind of underscores the place that we're at where nobody really knows what the heck is going on. It's kind of unfortunate for these students. I really feel for especially high schoolers who are graduating into a world that's going to be very different 5 years from now. Another thing to keep in mind, CMS has another challenge where they are really concerned about students' data and students' names being plugged into AI and what that could mean in the future. So they want to be really careful with that, and they want to lock down cybersecurity and address all those issues before they dive too deep and they become this leader in AI that they want to be.
Meanwhile, they're also dealing with something else, some other modern technology, cell phones. Cell phones in school is an increasing concern, and on Wednesday, state lawmakers passed, with bipartisan support, a bill requiring public school districts statewide to set policies that ban the use of phones during instructional time. Senator Jay Chaudhary says that there are already schools in the state that have instituted a ban, and they are seeing positive signs.
Our schools need to be sanctuaries of learnings. We know that not using cell phones during the day can result in our happier students and students that are less anxious. We know that a bell-to-bell restriction that's been implemented in both Granville County and Brunswick County have resulted in less behavior problems, too.
So aside from the obvious, Eli, what would this bill do?
Basically, it will force districts to set policies. Many of them have some policy already, but they're all over the map. So, you know, there would be more unity and clarity and less of a free-for-all among the 115 districts as to how much cell phone usage would be allowed. This is a movement that is picking up steam, not just in North Carolina, but nationwide. Just yesterday, I think Senator Alyssa Slotkin from Michigan gave a speech in which she proposed a nationwide ban on cell phone use in K-12 classrooms that would be enforced by the Education Department. I think there's a lot of research out there that phones can really mess with young people. I'm an oldie at this point. I didn't have a cell phone till after high school. I imagine if I had one in high school, I mean, in my day, we were playing with the TI-83 graphing calculators, and we were very distracted with the games you could play on those.
A worm on that was amazing.
Oh, yeah. And the Space Blasters one?
We live in weird times, though, because I had one lawmaker tell me that the most opposition they're getting to this is actually from parents who want to be in touch with their kids.
Yes.
And they brought up the point that back in their day, if you got in trouble, you would never, please don't call my mom. Today, kids are saying, oh, I'm in trouble. Call my mom. She'll come and handle this. So we just live in bizarre times where we have the cell phone bill, the AI issue that Alex is talking about, and trying to grapple this all together is crazy.
So this, I want my kids who are 7 and almost 5 to never have cell phones. I don't want them to ever think they can text me to get out of trouble. But at the same time, the tide is sweeping us all along. And are we going to be able to, you know, do that without moving to a homestead and full Luddite? I don't know.
Actually surprised to hear, David, that young people today know that phones can actually make calls. The bill would set restrictions for social media on school internet or devices that they provide, but they do provide exceptions for phones to be used during instruction if the teacher feels it's appropriate and in case of emergencies. But the bill does not ban TikTok in schools. Given the concerns that we've been hearing about TikTok over the last year, why not? No one can. I stumped the panel. That's okay. So the bill has gone to Governor Stein. Is he expected to sign it?
Yes, I believe this has broad support, and the governor is expected to.
Okay. So the state's fiscal year ends on Monday. It looks doubtful that legislators will reach an agreement on a budget. So what happens now?
Well, it's not like the federal government where there's a shutdown and, you know, things grind to a halt. In North Carolina, the spending basically continues at its current level. So, you know, state employees won't get raises immediately until there's a new budget. You know, teachers won't get raises in their base salary. New project funding doesn't come through, but it continues at its current level. So basically, things kind of grind on as they are. So you won't notice any immediate changes. It's not like the DMV is going to close on Monday. But the House and the Senate, both led by Republicans, are really far apart. So there's not an end in sight, and there's not clarity on when those things like state employee raises might be approved.
And they go on summer break next week. So it's likely that they'll go on summer break without a budget.
That's assured. Josh Stein has already said, issued his statement denouncing them for doing so.
The legislature voted unanimously yesterday, though, to pump more money into Hurricane Helene relief. That package contains $500 million in new funds and redirects several hundred million more dollars. Where is that redirection of money coming from?
So some of it is coming from state funds for roads and transportation improvements that will be redirected to fixing infrastructure in western North Carolina that is still damaged, you know, 9 months later. Some of it is federal funds from the EPA for water and water treatment that will be used to improve water infrastructure and water management infrastructure, water safety in western North Carolina, which was devastated by flooding.
And some of the money includes money for a tourism marketing campaign, because some areas have recovered and they need tourists. A lot of bills have been making their way through the General Assembly in this session, but one appears to be particularly controversial, and it deals with a potential ban on inland shrimp trawling. Alex, what would this bill do?
This bill, it would ban shrimp trawling within a half mile of the coast, and it would address some. Well, it's dead now. Let's get that dead. But it would address environmental concerns about dragging these nets through ecosystems and killing fish and doing more damage. But the commercial fishing industry really came out to Raleigh and made sure it did not advance.
Yeah, the hundreds of people turned out from the fishing industry, and Republican Representative Ed Goodwin's district includes most of the Albemarle Sound.
The shrimping industry is the backbone of North Carolina seafood industry, and to eliminate trawling in the Inner Banks will effectively destroy the whole system. The industry will be gone. You won't be able to pull up anywhere and get you some shrimp like I did last Saturday. Come home with two great big bags.
Opponents say this would wipe out jobs. It would devastate the shrimping industry in the state. Proponents argue it would protect natural habitats. And they say that shrimp trawling is one of the most destructive fishing practices in coastal waters. Well, David, the F-bomb is making the rounds of our political class. Donald Trump used the F-word this week when talking about Israel and Iran, and so did Waxhaw Mayor Robert Murray. It happened during a meeting of the town board of commissioners on Tuesday night as they discussed the tax rate and the budget.
I'm done too. You can make accusations about
that's not true. I'm done with all y'all. I'm done.
Why?
Well, first, Mike, let me say I really appreciate you associating me and the F-bomb together on public radio for my first news roundup. But this was really bickering between two totally different political factions within the Republican Party in Waxhaw. One group wanted to lower the tax rate all the way to about 26 cents. The other one wanted to keep it around 31, which the town manager recommended. He was fighting with his own political faction in this. It's kind of just off the wall in Waxhaw right now.
So this started, at least from the sound clip that WBTV has on their website, which was a part of the YouTube channel that Waxhaw normally keeps, but they took it down. But you have it. And it started out in what sounded like a calm exchange between Commissioner Richard Daunt and Mayor Pro Tem Brenda McMillan until the mayor interrupted.
So when it comes to any other vote of consequence, the three of you are quite happy to vote together against us, vote for your developer friends. But on this, now all of a sudden
you're making
you need
statements
us.
That are inaccurate and untrue. Please do not do that. Let's stick to the facts and the information in front of us. That is not true.
It is true.
That is not true.
Every
true.
Major
you
development.
Cannot, just like I can't speak for
you. You're looking for a
you
tax rate.
You cannot speak for me.
I'm done.
I'm done too. You can't
yes.
make accusations about
that's
something
what I'm
that's
done
not
with.
True.
I'm done with all y'all. I'm done. I'm done with the jokes. I'm done being coy. I'm done. It's 10:30. I am done. One of you groups needs to decide to move on this, and all you got to do is move a little. Move a freaking little. That's all I'm asking for.
I have to ask, do things normally get this heated in Waxhaw?
Not yes. by understanding, but Ryan says yes. He knows more
as,
than me.
As former Union County Weekly editor, Waxhaw, Indian Trail, Marvin, Weddington, they're all just so fun. I love it.
I got to say, as someone who has sat through hundreds of city council meetings, someone screaming, "I'm effing done," as they approach midnight is the most relatable thing I've heard in local politics in a long time.
The only other thing I'll point out is that it's really started with the bickering about who is friends with developers or not and construction. And I think that that is one of the major political things of our time.
How was this issue decided? Was it left? Was it tabled?
The tax rate will be at 29 cents, which is 2 cents lower than the town manager recommended and 3 cents higher than the other political factor.
There was some reaction to this outburst. Commissioner Jason Hall sent a statement to WBTV saying Waxhaw residents deserve better and criticized the mayor's lack of professionalism, I guess in reference to the profanity that the mayor used. But the tenor of our political conversations has certainly coarsened in recent years. As far as I can tell, no one has said boo about Donald Trump's use of the F word this week. Do we have two different standards in operation now? I need a yes or a no, and very quickly.
Yes, we still can't say it on air.
That's a fact. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on WFAE. All right. The area, this area, is no secret, is experiencing explosive growth, not just in Charlotte, but the surrounding communities as well. And this week, Fort Mill, David, took action. What did their town council do without profanity?
No profanity as far as I know, but they instituted a housing moratorium, that will prevent any new projects from moving forward until the end of the year. But that will not stop any of the 7,000-ish housing projects, both apartments, single-family homes that are moving forward right now. Their issue is about growth and how to maintain it properly. Would not be surprising to see some type of developer or builder file a lawsuit against the town, depending on how they navigated this on the front end.
Because they've experienced 48% growth since 2010, according to the Census Bureau. This moratorium for building passed unanimously. How long is it in effect?
until the end of the year, and that's when projects rezoning will start moving forward again.
And does that mean future projects can't be approved until then, or does it mean that projects that are underway have to stop?
Future projects okay. only. Projects that are underway can keep going forward.
Okay. CPCC, Central Piedmont Community College, is planning to build a training facility for CMPD and Charlotte Fire and Medic at their Matthews campus. It's been a bit controversial because some have called it a cop city. Similar to training facilities in other cities have gotten violent protests, actually, against them. And last April, a CPCC student filed a lawsuit against the school, saying it unfairly banned her from campus after she attended a public meeting about the facility. Very quickly, that suit's been dropped, right, Eli? Very quickly.
Yes, they basically settled, and neither side admitted wrongdoing, but they said, you can come back on campus, and we'll follow public meeting laws.
Okay, and with that, we have to stop, because we've completely run out of time. I don't know how that happened. Too many people, too much to talk about, I guess. Eli Portillo, senior editor of WFAE News. Ryan Pitkin, co-founder, editor of Queen City News. Alexander Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. And for his first time ever, on the roundup at least, David Hodges, a reporter for WBTV. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.